So I want to start today by talking a little bit more about karyotypes. You remember that's what you get if you stop a cell at metaphase. You squash the cell, you look at the picture of chromosomes, and then you line the chromosomes up in decreasing order of size. So either a karyotype can look something like this, or if the sister chromatids have stuck together, it might look like this. Or if you were doing, or sometimes it's even written this way. Now I'm just going to leave it like that. So in photographs, often the chromosomes appear to have only one chromatid because the two sister chromatids are stuck together. In diagrams, when people show banding, they often show only one chromatid, even if the chromosome has two. Now, why would they draw this picture instead of making it like this? If we're interested in the banding pattern, how does the banding pattern of the left half compare to the right? It's going to be exactly the same, as these are sister chromatids, two products of semi-conservative DNA replication. So if you're only interested in explaining the pattern or showing the pattern on one chromatid is sufficient because you know what would be on the other one. Now, what can you see from looking at a normal karyotype? You can clearly look at the total number of chromosomes. And you can see how many kinds of chromosomes. In this case, there are three kinds. And the number of kinds, you may remember, is symbolized by N, which in this case would be three. Now, there's also the question of how many of each kind. Is the cell haploid, diploid, triploid, etc.? This cell has two of everything. So what do you call it? You would call it diploid, and in other words, the ploidy is two. And of course, the total number of chromosomes is just the number of kinds times the number of each kind. Now, for each individual chromosome, though, you can see its size, you can see the position of the centromere, and if you do the appropriate technique, you can see the banding pattern. That means you can see the morphology, as they say, or the appearance of each chromosome, and you can tell all chromosomes apart. So if there are two pairs like this, by looking at the banding pattern, you can tell these two from those two. Okay. Now, if you look at a human karyotype, what do you see? For humans, N equals 23. So that means, and we are diploid, so there are 2N chromosomes in a cell. 2N is really just short for diploid. So if I made a karyotype, it would look something like this. It turns out that 22 pairs look the same whether the chromosomes come from a male or a female. But there is one pair of chromosomes that are different depending on whether this is the karyotype of a male or a female. The 22 that look the same no matter what are called autosomes, and the two that look different are called sex chromosomes. And in a female, there's a pair of big chromosomes. And since the centromere is in the middle and they are X-shaped, they're known as the X, or the X chromosome. But males have one big one and one very small one. And the small chromosome is known as the Y. Now, what this means is that females are said to be XX And males are said to be XY. Now, I have a question. What determines sex? Is it, well, there's two differences here. A male has only one X relative to two, and a male has a Y relative to a female. So it could be either one that's the determining factor, the presence of Y or the absence of a second X. To answer which it is, we actually have to say, we find out which it is from looking at individuals who have abnormal numbers of X's and Y's. So what I want to look at next is not just what can you learn from a normal karyotype, but what can you learn from an abnormal karyotype. A cell which is haploid, diploid, triploid, has a multiple of sets of chromosomes, is said to be euploid. But a cell that has missing or extra chromosomes is said to be aneuploid. Now, from looking at a karyotype, clearly you can see if there are missing or extra chromosomes. But you can see other additional rearrangements as well. And things you can just see in a karyotype are called chromosomal mutations. One of them is aneuploidy. But you can see other things as well. If a band is missing, or if bands are inverted, or if a piece with bands is tacked on to another chromosome, you can see any of these rearrangements. So you can see rearrangements. It's obvious what inversions are. It's obvious what deletions are. But one kind is a translocation. And that means something is attached to the wrong chromosome. So that means if a piece, this piece, was moved to another chromosome, that would be called a translocation. And you can tell from banding if there are extra or missing pieces, as you would see in a translocation. Now, suppose you're missing one gene. Can you see that? Well, if you're missing one band, can you see that? So the question is, how big is a band? A band is not one gene. A band is a block of genes, a large block. So all you can see here are large rearrangements that involve blocks of genes and thereby change the banding pattern. Now, mutations that are too small to see in a karyotype, because they involve just a few nucleotides or a few genes, those are usually called gene mutations. And you can pick those up because they change the DNA, and we've discussed many methods for looking at the DNA. But you can't see them in a karyotype. Now, there are various kinds of rearrangements and chromosomal mutations, but I want to focus on aneuploidy, where you have missing and extra chromosomes. And some examples of that are actually on handout 19B. Here we're looking at a cell which has only three pairs of chromosomes. So in the middle of 19B, you have a normal diploid that looks like this. Now, that's a normal diploid. But what if we're missing a chromosome? So the next one written over looks like this. Now, this cell is not euploid. It doesn't have the same number of each chromosome. It has two of the big and the small X's, but only one of the V's. So this cell is missing one chromosome. And this cell is said to be monosomic. Now, on the other hand, in the third case, there's two big X's, three V's, and two little X's. So again, there's the right number of X chromosomes, but there are three V-shaped ones where there ought to be two. So this cell has an extra chromosome, and as it says on your handout, this is trisomic. Now, what's the difference between trisomic and triploid? What would a triploid karyotype look like? How many of these?
Three.
So it'd be three of everything, or a 3N cell. But that's different from trisomic, which means three of one som, or three of one chromosome, but everything else is in twos like it's supposed to be. Now, monosomic, on the other hand, how is it different from haploid? Now, this ought to be called haposomic, and that ought to be called monoploid, but that's the way it is. Haploid is one of everything. Monosomic is two of everything, but one of one chromosome. Okay. Now, it turns out that aneuploidy of the autosomes is almost always lethal. So, if you have an extra or missing chromosome 1, too bad. Extra or missing chromosome 2, too bad. Now, this lethality is very early. Most aneuploidies lead to spontaneous abortions, otherwise known as miscarriages, often so early the person never knows they are pregnant. So most aneuploidies self-destruct. The embryo does not develop properly. However, there is one aneuploidy of the autosomes which is compatible with development of the fetus into an embryo and a live birth and development into a child, even to an adult, and that is trisomy 21. Now, the way we've written it, it looks like number 22 should be the smallest. 22 looks the smallest to the eyeball or with a microscope, but 21 actually has the least genetic material. So what this is saying is if you have three copies of the chromosome with the least number of genes, that's compatible with surviving. But if you have extra copies of any of the other chromosomes, extra copies of more genes, it's too bad. And if you're missing, if you're monosomic for any of the autosomes, it's virtually always lethal. But if you have trisomy 21 or three copies of 21, the result is what is called Down or Down syndrome. Now, in Down syndrome, the individual is usually retarded. There are other physical abnormalities, and the people usually get Alzheimer's at a very early age. Does this person have any unusual alleles of anything? Yes? Well, allele is a copy of the DNA, not a phenotype. Does the person have an unusual phenotype? Yes. The person usually has a shape, the face is different. But what I meant is if you look at the DNA of this person, if you look at their three copies of 21, are these normal 21s? And the answer is yes. The problem here is not mutations in the sense of changes in the DNA sequence. The problem is too many copies of this normal DNA sequence. This is called a gene dosage effect. For many genes, there is no regulation like repression or induction in eukaryotes. So if you have two copies of the gene, each copy is read out to make mRNA and protein, and you get a certain amount of protein. If you have three copies, you get 1.5 times the usual amount of protein. If you have one copy, you get half. Now, in this case, at least for some of these genes, if you make 1.5 times the normal amount of protein, that causes the abnormalities in these individuals. One of the genes here codes for the protein that piles up in Alzheimer's and gums up the brain. So if you have three copies of that gene instead of two, you make abnormal amounts of the protein, and the protein piles up early, and you get symptoms of Alzheimer's much, much earlier than most people do if they get it. Usually people get it in their 60s or later. People with Down syndrome usually get Alzheimer's in their 30s. Now, we have just said that aneuploidy of virtually all the autosomes is lethal, with this one exception. But aneuploidy of the sex chromosomes is not. There are individuals who are XO and individuals who are XXY. Of course, normal females are XX, normal males are XY. Now, what is XO means? Only one sex chromosome. The O means I know there's supposed to be a second one, but there isn't any, I didn't forget. That's why you put in the O. XXY means two X's and a Y. Now, individuals with no X are not viable. But one X, two X's, doesn't matter. Both of these are viable. Now, they do have some abnormalities. Individuals with XO are said to have Turner syndrome. People who are XXY are said to have Klinefelter's. And these involve some abnormalities of structure, though usually not with Klinefelter's, and partial or complete sterility. One question all of this raises is how do you get aneuploid individuals in the first place? Well, the short answer is mistakes in meiosis, and we'll come back to how it happens. But we have to do normal meiosis first, and then we'll see how you can get mistakes and you get these individuals. But the existence of these aneuploid individuals gives us a chance to answer our earlier question, what determines maleness? Is it the Y, or is it the absence of the second X? So let me ask you to fill this in. We know that these individuals are male, and these individuals are female. But now, let's suppose the critical thing is presence of Y, or the critical thing is having only one X. In that case, what would you predict for the sex here and the sex there? If it's one X that makes you male, or if it's the Y that makes you male? So take a minute and figure out what goes there. What would be the result? The O represents no second sex chromosome, just one X. Now, let's give this a shot. If it's the one X that does it, what sex will an XO be? If two X's is female and one X is male, this is male. In which case, what's XXY? That would be female. On the other hand, if Y is the critical thing, then what will an XO be? Female, no Y, right? And what will XXY be? Male. Well, it turns out in humans and in flies, the first two are the same. In both humans and flies, XY is male and XX is female. But when it comes to these individuals with aneuploidy, it's different in the two cases. Most higher organisms have some way of coping with the fact that either males have less X's than they should and females have too many, depending on your point of view. It's one way or the other. But there's obviously a difference between the number of X's in a male and a female. And both are normal, at least according to some definitions. So that must mean that there is a normal mechanism for coping with either one or two X's and coming out more or less with the same function. In flies, the critical thing seems to be the number of X's. So in flies, this is the setup. But in humans, it appears that the Y is critical, and it's this one. With flies, the Y doesn't contribute all that much to maleness. The critical thing is the number of X's. And there's a mechanism for turning down the amount of protein per X so that XX and X make about the same amount of protein. But in mammals, the way it works is that the Y is the critical thing. The Y has relatively few genes, but it has one gene which kicks in the development of maleness. So femaleness is the default in mammals, but if there is an active SRY gene on the Y, that kicks in the production of the appropriate transcription factors and hormones for male development. But this still leaves us with the question, in humans, why are extra X's tolerated? This is a male with an extra X. This is a female, but has only one X. Why? How does that work? Well, the short answer is that in humans, in each individual cell, only one X works. So one X is working in every human cell, and if there are additional X's, they are shut down. And we'll explain how that works later. But I want to come back to the question of how do mistakes in meiosis generate aneuploids? XO, XXY, or trisomy 21. And to answer that question, we have to first look at normal meiosis. And that's on handout, two of your handouts. And I want to first look at the outline, which is on 19B. No, take it back, 20A. 20A on the bottom. Now, we already said last time what you need meiosis for. You need meiosis to keep the karyotype constant from generation to generation. The cell that I contribute has to have half the usual number of chromosomes. The cell from my partner has to have half the usual number. So my children will have the usual number instead of double. So that's what you need meiosis for. Well, I can think of a lot easier ways to do it. I mean, the usual way of reproducing is much more fun, but it would save ourselves a lot of trouble if you could just sort of, take one cell, put in a bottle, grow up a kid. Like you do with a plant, you take a little leaf off, you stick it in a bottle, grows a few roots, you plant it, you got a new plant. No sweat. Clonal asexual reproduction. Why bother with all this mating business? Well, you know the answer. You'd much rather do it that way, I suppose. But it does have a lot of, you got to find a mate, you got to get on with it, etc. So the question is, why bother from the biological point of view? But we already explained earlier that from the biological point of view, the advantage of sex is that you make new combinations of the genetic material. So if you start out with one individual, say, whose chromosomes look like that, and one whose chromosomes look like this, if you were to reproduce by the take one cell, put it in a bottle method, all the descendants of this individual would have identical chromosomes. all the descendants of this one would also. But if we take do meiosis, we pick one from this, one chromosome 1, one chromosome 2, it means the gametes from these individuals then get it together, and now we get in the offspring a new combination. And if these in turn mate, we will eventually get every possible combination of pink and white chromosomes. So we reshuffle the chromosomes by sexual reproduction. Now there's a second kind of reshuffling that occurs, and that is because of crossing over or recombination. We haven't talked about the details, but if you have a pair of homologs, in the first case they're both pink, it doesn't make any difference. But if these two homologs, which don't have to be the same but have equivalent genes, if you get crossing over here, meaning a cut and rejoin, you can now get chromosomes that are part derived from the maternal and part derived from the paternal. That is, I inherited white from one of my parents and pink from the other. Now, in my individual cells, the white stick with the white and the pink sticks with the pink. But in the germ cells that produce gametes, eggs, there is crossing over. So I can pass on to my children chromosomes that are part pink and part white. So I can both reshuffle the chromosomes and I can recombine them. And as a result, my descendants can have all kinds of new combinations of genes and chromosomes. And that is presumably the reason why virtually every organism on Earth, virtually, indulges in sex or some method for reshuffling the genetic material. So if we're going to bother to do it then, how are we going to do it? So that overview on the bottom of your handout captures some of the critical stuff. So in this overview, we're going to start with just one, a cell that has only one pair of chromosomes to keep it simple. So we have one pair of homologous chromosomes. Now, meiosis and mitosis start the same way, probably because meiosis evolved from mitosis. So before you can do any cell division at all, you have to double the DNA. And you have to go from chromosomes with one chromatid each to chromosomes with two chromatids each. Now, that means when we get all done, what do we want in a gamete? A double white, a double wiggly, a white and a wiggly? We want either a wiggly or a straight, either a white or a pink. So when we get done, we're going to have to actually get four cells because we have four copies here of the genetic information in this chromosome. We had one copy, two homologs, one copy each. Now we have two homologs, two copies each. So what's going to happen at first division is we're going to separate the wiggly double from the straight double. And then in the second division, we're going to separate the two chromatids of the wiggly and the two chromatids of the straight. So, when did we do this doubling business? Did we do it in meiosis? We really did it before in interphase in the previous S period. The DNA synthesis part of interphase warming up. And then we have two divisions. Now, this is different from mitosis. If we were doing mitosis, what would happen? Well, we do the same thing in interphase, and we get this far. But if we were doing mitosis now, how would we divide it up? What would each daughter cell get? Well, we'd get two daughter cells, not four. And what would they get here? Somebody said half, but which half? Do we get two whites and two pinks? No, because we get one white chromatid and one pink wiggly in each cell. So in fact, each daughter cell has exactly the same genetic information as the original. But that's not true with meiosis. Each cell has half. Now, how do you keep track of this? Well, this cell has two chromosomes. What about here? How many chromosomes? Still has two. What doubled? The DNA content and the number of chromatids went up, but the number of chromosomes is the same. Now, what about here? What happened to the number of chromosomes? We actually cut it in half, and then we cut it in half again. So if we started with a cell with one pair, with two chromosomes, it's 2, 2, 1, 1. Now, what if we had a cell like a human? We'd have 23 pairs. The cell would have whatever the number of kinds in, it would be a diploid cell. So if it has 10 pairs, it has 20 chromosomes, whatever. Okay, now what? So what happens when you get to here? How many chromosomes? It's still 2N, right here. What's the number of chromosomes here? Per cell. It's just N. And what's the number here? It's still just N. But obviously, something has changed from here and here. And here. We know something changed here, but something also changed here. The DNA content changed. So one way of keeping track of this is to say we doubled the DNA, we have the DNA, we have it again. So what you do is you define who has the absolute minimum amount of DNA. Which cell? These guys have the least amount of DNA. So you call the DNA per cell C. Now that doesn't mean the DNA in one chromosome. It means the DNA in a set of chromosomes. So if this were humans, how many chromosomes would there be here? You start with 46, you end up with 23. So there'd be 23 single chromosomes. But whatever N is, there's one set of single chromosomes in there, and the amount of DNA in that is called C. Now that makes it possible to consider everything in multiples of C. If that cell has C amount of DNA, what does this cell have? It has 2C. What about this cell? 4C. What about this cell? And now, back to C again. So N keeps track of the number of chromosomes, and the C value keeps track of the amount of DNA per cell. Now, this is from the point of view of all the cells. We start out with one cell, then we get two cells, then we get four cells. The top of your handout is from the point of view of what's in one cell. So if you look in the middle where it says one pair, so one pair, this is what's in one cell, this is what's in one cell, then this is what's in one cell, and then this is what's in one cell. But all that's shown there is the chromosomes. But just to be sure you get it, if you look at the top case, I mean the left case, there we're looking at a cell that has not one pair of chromosomes, but three. To put it another way, N equals three. So to be sure we understand what's going on here, if we started out with three pairs, this is what they would look like at the beginning of interphase. What they look like after S? Well, you can always cheat. Look at your handout. At the end of S, everything's doubled. All the DNA is doubled. It's two chromatids per chromosome. Now, what happens after first division? What does one cell get? it gets one of these, one of these. So we're not drawing all this out, just one. So the chromosomes per cell now, its chromosome number is half what it was. But what happened to the DNA content? It just went down in half. So we started with a DNA content, and you notice there's a column which says DNA content per cell, which is written on the right, that you started with 2C, and then you went up to 4C, and now down to 2C again. And what happens after second division? What's one cell going to get? One of these chromatids, one of these chromatids, one of these sisters. So again, we're down to C. Now you can also look here, the column next to it, which has chromosomes per cell. This was DNA. The column to the right, the next column to the left was chromosomes per cell. So what were they this time? How many chromosomes in this cell? Well, the number is 6, right? But in terms of N, what is it? This is 2N. What is it here? It's still 2N. Even though the chromosomes are the double, the total number of chromosomes is still the same. Because whether a chromosome has one chromatid and looks like this, or whether a cell has two chromatids and looks like one of these, it's still called one chromosome. It's either a single with one chromatid or a double with two. What's in a chromatid, by the way? A single chromatid has how many DNA molecules in it? In here. Is it one or two? Is it double-stranded or single-stranded? So it's one double-stranded molecule is in here. And now there are two double-stranded molecules in here, one in this chromatid, one in the other sister. So each of the lines here is a double-stranded DNA molecule. All right, so we went from 2N, what's here? Still 2N. What's here? 1N, yes. And here? Still N. Okay. Okay. So we maybe should look at how would this work if we had... I want to try it just to be sure everybody's got it. Suppose N is 11. Then after first division, how many chromosomes? And how much DNA? This is per cell. What would it be? So give that a shot. Maybe instead of this one, I should ask also the number of chromatids. And I want a number, not ends. What's the actual number? So this one would only be in C, but in terms of actual number, how many chromosomes and how many chromatids? N is 11 after first division. I'm asking you. N, the N for this organism is 11. And we start with a diploid organism. It has to be diploid or it can't do meiosis. So if N is 11, how many chromosomes did I start with? When I was here? I had 22 to start with. How many did I have after first division?
11.
I hear a vote for 11. Any other numbers? Nobody will admit to it. Okay. So what's going to happen after first division is you're going to have cut the number in half. But how many chromatids are you going to have? You're going to have 22 because although you've cut the chromosome number in half, each chromosome has two chromatids. How many DNA molecules? 11 or 22? There's actually 22 DNA molecules because every chromatid contains one double-stranded DNA molecule. Okay. So let's move on now and actually look at the details of meiosis. So that's diagram for you on 19A in parallel with mitosis. This to make it fit. Okay. Now we've already done the mitosis half, but it's actually important to sort of compare the two to see where they differ. So let's start over here. You notice that mitosis and meiosis both start the same way, that you have to have interphase so you can double the DNA. And then you have prophase. When the nuclear membrane breaks down and the chromosomes start to condense or tighten up. Now, what's the difference? This is where you start to see a difference. One big difference is that in mitosis, the two chromosomes act independently. It doesn't matter whether they're homologs or not. Each one is going to act by itself. But in prophase one of meiosis, this is when crossing over or recombination occurs. This is where you get cutting and rejoining or the exchange of equivalent pieces between a chromatid of one chromosome and a chromatid of its homolog. So this is where crossing over occurs. Now, remember that sometimes the two sister chromatids are stuck together. So at this phase, at this stage, it often looks like a pair and not like a foursome. So what we're saying is at that stage, it is quite common when you look in the microscope that your doubled chromosome just looks like one. And for that reason, some people refer to this structure as a bivalent. Bi implies there's only two of them, because there are the two homologs. This one is pairing with this one. But the two halves or chromatids of this one may be stuck together, the two of this one stuck together, so it looks like a pair, instead of looking like a foursome. To emphasize that it's really four copies, Some people call it instead a tetrad, to emphasize that it's four copies of the genetic information, or the DNA, and you're going to distribute it to four cells. Now, another thing that's important is that prophase one of meiosis can be very protracted. It can take a very long time. In a human female, it can take 40 years. The reason is, when a human female is born, all of her potential egg cells have reached this stage. And then they sit around. And then starting at puberty, 12 whatever years later, one cell a month finishes the job. So by the time a woman is 40 and the last egg is coming through, it's been sitting around for 40 years like this. And that is thought to contribute to the fact that nondisjunction, or failure to sort out properly, gets more common as women get older. And we'll come back to how that goes. So now, what's the next stage, however long it lasts? For this, where mitosis, we would have metaphase. We have metaphase both times. Except since there are two divisions, with meiosis, we call it metaphase one. Now, what happens in metaphase? Things that are going to get separated line up in a plane. If we're talking mitosis, who do we want to separate? We want to separate the two sister chromatids. So chromosomes line up, each one by himself, so that you can now pull one chromatid to one pole and one chromatid to the other pole for every chromosome. But what's supposed to happen at meiosis? We're not supposed to separate the two sister chromatids. We're supposed to separate homologs. So how do you think we should line them up? We should line them up so that they're paired, so that one homolog is going to go up and one homolog is going to go down. So for each pair, it's going to be something like this. And remember, everything is attached to spindle fibers, which we've left off the picture. So the spindle fibers now, instead of pulling the two sister chromatids apart, are going to pull the two homologs, or members of a pair, apart. So in the next stage, if it's mitosis, the protein holding the centromeres together is going to come apart. But if it's meiosis, the glue is going to hold. And we're going to keep these two together and these two sisters together, but we're going to separate the two homologs. So the next phase that we've got is anaphase, or ana 1 for meiosis. So we're going to pull the two sisters apart. If we're talking mitosis. But if we're talking meiosis, we're going to pull the two homologs apart. Now, there's something I should put in here. There's only one pair of chromosomes here, but we have 23. All eukaryotes have more than one. If one pair lines up like this, what about all the other pairs? All the pairs are lined up on this plane. But who's on top? This is not all the missionary position. It's not that all the male chromosomes are on top from your dad and all the females on the bottom. It's all mixed up. Each pair lines up independently of all the other pairs. So for any one pair, the one from the paternal line could be on top, or the one from the maternal. So that means that if there are multiple pairs, every possible combination you can get. It's perhaps easier to see if you have only two, as in a case like this. The two pairs are going to be like that. So this could be maternal, paternal, and this could be either way. So this maternal chromosome can go either with the maternal or the paternal 50-50. That turns out to be very important when we get to actual genetics and distribution of the genes. The genes on this copy can go with either set of genes on the other chromosome, even Steven. But let's come back to our mitosis. So we've now finished, we now need to put things back. So we have telophase. You start to put back the nuclear membrane. The chromosomes start to stretch out. And if it's mitosis, that leads to two daughter cells, smaller but with the same genetic information as the original. But now if this is meiosis, again we go through a telophase, which looks similar, except remember inside your chromosomes are still double. Now, we've got the right number of chromosomes in each daughter cell, but we don't have the right number of chromatids. And that's why we're going to have to divide again, because each of these chromatids belongs in a separate cell. Each of these chromatids belongs in a separate cell. Now, we have two divisions, but the critical thing about the second division is there's no interface. There's no additional doubling of DNA. So we're just going to divide again whatever we happen to have. And it turns out that this daughter cell stage and the prophase stage are very short or missing, so we go more or less directly to metaphase 2. Now, how should we line it up this time? What do we want to do? We want to separate these two sister chromatids. So, in fact, we should line them up on the metaphase plate. Now, if this were a human, there'd be 23 double chromosomes. And all 23 would be spread out this way. So I can send one chromatid up, one chromatid down. But again, it's going to be random for each one, which is on top, which is on the bottom. So now, finally, in anaphase 2, now we're going to separate the two sister chromatids. They're going to be pulled by fibers to the two sides. But in order to do this, we finally had to split the protein holding the two centromeres together. We didn't do it in the first division, but you do it in the second one. And now you have to have a second telophase leading to a second daughter cell. And I've run out of space, and it's on your handout anyway. But we've done the critical thing here of dividing up the genetic material. So we're going to get four cells, each with one copy. Now, if this is higher organisms, meiosis gives you four products, but all four products may not survive. In the production of male sperm, every meiosis gives you four sperm. But in the production of female eggs, each meiosis only gives you one egg. So essentially, three of these shrivel up, and you're left with one. And all the cytoplasm that should have been in the shriveled ones are in the big one. So you end up with only one of the possible genetic combinations. The other three are jettisoned. Now, this is all I want to say about the fine points of meiosis. There are many more details to this, which are outlined in your textbooks and which you'll discuss if you take development or cell biology, such as how do the spindle fibers move the chromosomes, etc. A lot of that's explained in Becker if you're interested. But I'm going to stop here because I'm mostly interested in just how is the genetic material distributed, not how it got there so much. So now let me ask what questions people have about this stuff so far before we go on. Yeah? What decides which of the eggs are jettisoned? I think it's random. What happens is when you get to this stage, instead of having two equal-sized cells, you have one large cell and one small cell. And which nucleus is in which side, I think, is random. And this is called a polar body. And then when this cell divides, which is one of these two, one of the cells is viable and the other is a polar body, so there's going to be actually a second polar body. So when you get finished, you're going to have two little cells and the big one. So what we're saying is when this thing divides, let's say it's this one, then one of these you're going to have this. This is diagrammed in both textbooks, I think. Yeah?
Going back to trisomy 21,
yes.
you talked about the protein being used at 1.5 times the amount that going up the brain and causing Alzheimer's earlier. I think it was heard that there was an Alzheimer's gene, so wouldn't you have to have the right allele?
Okay, she's saying to get Alzheimer's, you have to have the Alzheimer's gene. There are mutations that increase the chance that you will get Alzheimer's. And some of these mutations are in genes for the same protein we're talking about. And some of them are in other genes that process that that code for proteins that process that protein. So there are genes that increase the chance of getting Alzheimer's. But what we're talking about here is you don't have those abnormal alleles at all. You just have too much of the normal protein. Yeah?
When you said that if you have the chromosomal abnormalities, usually it's fatal at a very early stage. What is the mechanism? Is the cell not able to copy? What is it that allows it to automatically know that it
is? What makes an aneuploid cell stop dividing? I don't know a simple answer to that, except clearly it has unbalanced amounts of protein. But exactly what that triggers or how, I don't know. Presumably, something that is essential doesn't get made properly. But how the cell detects that, I don't know. Okay. Yeah?
You mentioned how in humans only one of the X's works.
Uh-huh.
I guess my question is, if only one X works, then why... Is that only on the autosomes?
Her question is about it's only one X works. We're going to come back to that. When it comes to the autosomes, both autosomes generally work. But when it comes to X's, only one of them does. And we'll return to how that works. Yeah?
When you're talking about crossing over, it happens between the two homolog chromosomes that are both... two DNA strands in each chromosome, right?
Yes. His point is that crossing over occurs when you have two chromatids here and two chromatids here. Yes.
So it happens on four strands of DNA.
So there are actually four strands of DNA. Now, for every individual cut and rejoin event, two chromatids are involved and two chromatids are just staying the same. Okay? And we'll discuss that some more later, too. Yeah? I'm not sure what your question is, but if you're saying the normal meiosis is thought to produce euploid cells, I don't know. I think something like 10 or 20% of spontaneous abortions are aneuploid. So you could say that aneuploidy isn't that rare, but surviving aneuploidy is very rare. when you think about it, it's actually something to be very thankful for, that most developmental abnormalities self-destruct. It's also something of an amazing fact that any of us have developed at all. When you consider all the things that have to go right, but a lot of them did. Now, before we can explain how you get aneuploid individuals, we have to stop for a minute and ask, in the life cycle of an organism, where do you do meiosis? Where do you do mitosis? So want to look at that thing called supercycle on your last handout on 20B. And then we'll consider how you get the aneuploids. Organisms have different life cycles, and it's traditional to teach them all separately, but I've combined them into one summary diagram. But let's start with the human life cycle, which we understand the best. We consider ourselves. We are multicellular diploids. So on the right there, the picture I'm going to end up with is the same one on your handout. So we have many diploid cells in our body. And most of those cells divide only by mitosis. And in fact, we started out with a single cell. The egg and the sperm got it together. Each of them was haploid. And they, two of those, got it together and gave us a single diploid cell. And then that cell divided by mitosis to give all the cells virtually in your body. This single cell that comes from the fusion of an egg and a sperm is called a zygote. And the cells that are going to do the fusion, which in our case are eggs and sperm, are called gametes. Now, the reason there's a dotted line down the middle is that everything on the left is haploid or N, and everything on the right is diploid or 2N. So, virtually all of our cells divide only by mitosis, but they specialize. So some become liver, some become brain, some become skin, etc. But as part of that specialization, some of them become what are called germ cells, meaning that their special job is to divide by meiosis and make gametes. So one kind of specialized cell is a germ cell. These are not the gametes, but the progenitors of the gametes. The cells that, if they go through meiosis, will give you gametes. Now, to get from haploid to diploid, you have to have fusion, or as we call it, fertilization. And to get from diploid back to haploid, obviously you have to have meiosis. Now, this is the human life cycle, that, in fact, of all mammals and most higher animals, that the thing you see walking around is diploid. The only haploid stage is the gamete. And gametes then fuse and make a diploid zygote, and it's mitosis from there. Now, that's basically a diploid life cycle. The organism is diploid almost all the time, except for this one. There's a converse life cycle, which many very simple organisms, and algae, for example, have, where they're basically haploid, except for a temporary diploid. This is diploid, except for a temporary haploid. So how would that go? There, the multicellular organism, or the many individual cells, are all haploid. And how do you get the diploid? By specialization. The cells are already haploid. But most of these cells are specialized to do the equivalent of brain, leaves, something special, and they divide only by mitosis. And in fact, the way they got there is when haploid cells were made, the haploids didn't go and fuse and give you diploids again. Instead, the haploids divided by mitosis. So the products of meiosis, haploid, divided by mitosis to make lots of haploids. But we said this is basically a haploid organism. So what does that mean? That means that when two gametes fuse to make you a diploid, the diploid is the only diploid stage, the zygote. As soon as you make it, it goes through meiosis. So it goes through meiosis to give you a haploid again. So this dotted line, the first one, gives you a diploid life cycle, and the second dotted line gives you the haploid life cycle. So let's just see if we've got it here. Maybe I'll put it in pink to make it clearer. In this life cycle, the product of meiosis, haploid, divides by mitosis to make more. A few of those specialize for fusion. They fuse, they make a diploid, but then the diploid goes through meiosis right away and goes back to haploid. No hanging out on the diploid side. So this is the basic haploid life cycle. Now, there's only one other piece of terminology here. If the job of a haploid cell is to fuse and make a zygote, we call it a gamete. If the job of a haploid cell is to divide by mitosis, we call it a spore. Now, there's the basic haploid life cycle, and there's the basic diploid life cycle. But there are some organisms that go through both. They do the whole shebang. So they do the whole outer rim. Higher plants are like that. They have a diploid phase. They make haploid spores that divide by mitosis to make a haploid stage. These specialize to make gametes and so on. But in higher plants, the thing you see is diploid. And the haploid part is very small and inside. But there are a few simple plants where the two halves are both visible to the naked eye. And the one that you've probably seen the most is moss. The fuzzy green stuff is haploid. The little spore capsules on the top, the little stalks, are diploid. So what happens here is the product of meiosis germinates. It goes through mitosis and makes many haploids. That's what you see right here, the green fuzzy stuff. Then a couple of those cells specialize, they turn into gametes, and they fuse. So sitting here would be a diploid zygote. The diploid zygote would multiply by mitosis and make this stalk thing. Inside the stalk head, meiosis occurs. So meiosis, so you got a zygote, you went through mitosis to make the stalk. In the stalk head, you did meiosis, and now you have spores. And those little spores, which are haploid, will land on the ground, germinate, and make more fuzzy stuff as they divide by mitosis. So this is one of the few cases where you can see both the haploid and the diploid. That is, with the naked eye. Now, to understand how you get aneuploids, you have to think that both you have mistakes in meiosis to get gametes with unusual numbers of chromosomes, and then they meet by fertilization or fusion gametes with normal numbers of chromosomes, and you have yourself an aneuploid. So let's see how that works first by looking at the part of the mistakes in meiosis. So you want to look at the bottom of your handout. And what you really want to do is turn it sideways. If you turn it sideways, it looks exactly like this in the middle. Maybe we should get rid of mitosis to make it a little simpler. But this is the picture in the middle. This is normal meiosis. A pair of chromosomes, doubles, separate the homologs, and then make individuals. So let me take off the complications here. Just this one. Now, what kind of mistakes are we talking about? Mistakes in this process are known as non-disjunction. Meaning mistakes in the distribution. Now, what does non-disjunction mean? Disjunction means separation. So this means failed to separate. You could have just called it junction. It means things that were supposed to separate didn't, and they stayed together. So the mistake can be at first division. So if you look at the top of your handout, sideways that is, it could be that at first division, these two chromosomes, these two homologs don't separate from each other. And they end up in the same cell. As shown in your handout. So instead of one ending up in each daughter cell, both end up in one and neither in the other. Now, does that mean this cell is empty? Remember, the other 22 chromosomes are doing their thing. And they're not screwing up, just as this one mistake. And so, in fact, there are 22 more in here and 22 more in there, but we're ignoring them. But there's no representative of this pair in this cell. Now, second division occurs completely normally. So this cell divides into two, and neither of them has a representative of the chromosome pair in question. And this cell divides in two. But second division is sort of like mitosis. So each daughter cell gets one of these chromatids, one straight and one wiggly. So instead of having either a wiggly or a straight, some of the gametes have both a wiggly and a straight, and some don't have anything from this pair. Now that's nondisjunction at first division. Now what about nondisjunction at second division? The problem can be with the wiggly, or the problem can be with the straight. And both cases are drawn on your handout. For example, with the straight, what could happen is that these two fail to separate. This is drawn underneath. So that both of them end up in one cell and neither in the other. Except in your handout, it's the other way around. It's like this. Now, these two chromatids separate eventually, but they don't separate until late. And as a result, the two of them are in one cell and neither chromatid is in the other. Now, if you have this mistake of this cell at second division, usually the other cell does what it's supposed to and makes two normal gametes. But it could have been the other way around. It could have been this cell did what it was supposed to, but this cell engaged in nondisjunction, and as shown on your handout, what that would give you, except there's no room to write it here, it's written up here on your handout, that you would get one with nothing and one with two wigglies. So normal meiosis is either you get a wiggly or a straight. As a result of nondisjunction at either first or second division, you can get one of each, a straight and a wiggly, or in fact two straights, or two wigglies, or none of the above. So what? What do gametes do? Well, if we go back and look at our handout here, what gametes do is they fuse with another gamete to make a zygote. And then the zygote divides by mitosis. So what kind of zygote are we going to get out of these? If you have a normal gamete and it meets a normal gamete, now, for this purpose, I don't really need to draw straights and wigglies. The real issue is how many. A normal gamete has one. So if one of this pair. So I get two. I'm going to leave this one off. So whether it's straight or wiggly, a gamete with one meets a gamete with one, and I get back two like I'm supposed to. But you notice from nondisjunction, you can get a cell that has no representative of this pair, or a cell that has two. Now, what happens if that meets a normal gamete? Cell with normal gamete number, with number chromosome, normal chromosome number, meets cell with none. You just have one where you're supposed to have two. What will that give you? Well, are there any other chromosomes here? Remember, the other 22 are behaving themselves. So we have two of everything, but we have one of this pair. What do you call that? That's monosomy. But what if this chromosome with this cell with two meets a cell with one? This is trisomy. Two of everything else, but three of this pair. This is how you get trisomy 21, which leads to Down syndrome. Now, to see if you sort of got this one, how do you get an XO? Well, it's sort of like our picture up there where the straight and the wiggly, one is the X and one is the Y in a male. And in a female, they're actually both X's. So how can you get an XO? It means one gamete had an X, one gamete had no sex chromosome. So when did nondisjunction occur? Mom or dad? Well, a mom is supposed to make gametes with an X, right? It could make one with none. What's dad supposed to make? X or Y? Could it be none? So in fact, can you get an X from either parent?
Yes.
Yeah. Can you get nothing from either parent?
Yes.
By mistake, yes. So this could be either way. One of the parents had an undisjunction, one didn't. How do you get X, X, Y? So somebody says it has to be the mother, meaning that you got an XX from the mom and a Y from the dad, right? Is that the only way to do it?
No.
What else could have happened? You could have gotten an XY from the dad and an X from the mom. Now, you can't get a Y from anybody but the dad. But the difference is, how do you get an XX from a female? Is the mistake at first division or at second division? Well, you try that one. And what about with a male, how do you get an XY? Is it first division or is it second? So I'm not going to answer that question. So you can go home and try it. Where was the mistake in each of these questions? We know which parent, but which division? And next time we'll talk about how you turn off one of the X's and how we know.